From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Today, the communities of Rock Hill, South Carolina, and Bryan, Texas, are reeling from mass shootings that happened yesterday, leaving a total of 6 people dead and another 6 injured. We know 2020 was the deadliest year for gun violence in decades. Just yesterday, President Biden unveiled some executive orders on gun control. But to pass any legislation, he'd need to keep every Democrat on board and somehow attract 10 Republicans, which seems unlikely to happen.
And the president has a very similar problem with his infrastructure plan that he's trying to get through Congress. We're going to talk about it all with our Friday Politics Roundtable. We've got Eugene Daniels, White House correspondent for Politico and co-author of the Politico Playbook. Eugene, good to speak with you.
Hey there. Happy Friday, everybody.
Indeed. And Tamara Keith, White House correspondent for NPR. Tam, good to speak with you, too.
Good to be with you.
Okay, so on these executive orders, Biden announced 6 of them on guns, including requiring background checks for buyers of ghost guns. These are guns that you assemble from kits. He also spoke about what's on his wish list, including ending immunity from lawsuits for gun manufacturers.
If I get one thing on my list, the Lord came down and said, Joe, you get one of these, give me that one. Because I tell you what, there would be a come-to-the-Lord moment these folks would have real quickly.
Tam, how far can the president go on guns without Congress?
He can only go so far. There are limits to executive authority. And in fact, the president didn't sign executive orders on those measures. He asked the Justice Department to do rulemaking and regulations to try to rein in what are known as ghost guns or these stabilizing braces for semi-automatic pistols that make them function more like a semi-automatic rifle. But these are regulatory processes that will take a long time and will likely face legal challenges. And so there really is only so much that a president can do through executive action. And executive actions, even if they make it through court, aren't particularly durable because the next president from a different party or with a different viewpoint can overrule, can come up with their own executive action or their own regulatory framework that will reverse that.
So, Eugene, if the president really can't do all that much with these announcements, do you think they're going to satisfy activists who want him to go boldly on this issue?
You know, there was already some frustration that the president hadn't announced any kind of executive actions up until this point. We obviously had those pair of mass shootings a couple of weeks ago to kind of kick this back into the national conversation. And so people were already upset. I think they have been sated a little bit. They're happy to hear this rhetoric. They're happy to see, you know, some of these measures. But like Tamara was saying, they are regulations and they are not binding for as long as they would like. And so they want Congress to do something. And something you kind of outlined in your intro is that the House has passed 3 of these bills, and the president talked about those 3 kind of something on background checks and some 2 other bills. And what is not happening in the Senate is it's not going to pass the Senate because they need those 10 Republicans. They have to keep the Democratic Party together, and they need those 10 Republicans. Same thing with infrastructure, same thing with voting rights. And so we're back to this very wonky conversation that we keep having about the filibuster and, you know, what is going to push, if anything, the party and Biden to really, really push for Democratic senators like Manchin and others to jump on board to get rid of the filibuster?
Well, on this point, Eugene, I mean, I know your publication, Politico, spoke with the Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey. He's a Republican. He says he wants to work with Joe Biden on gun safety legislation. So do you see any place where there could be common ground? And what about those red state Democrats that we have to consider as well?
No, I think absolutely. There's always a huge, you know, conversation about gun rights. And this is, you know, I can't think of another group on the Hill that does lobbying that is, you know, has such whiplash, right? You have, there's all this national conversation about, you know, background checks, which are extremely, extremely popular with the American people. That bill has never happened. Pat Toomey obviously said he's not giving up. He wants to do this gun deal. They're going to keep having these conversations. And something that, you know, when I talk to advocates in the gun safety realm, they say because of how the NRA, they feel is kind of kneecapped at this point, because of the bankruptcy filing, some other scandals, they feel more confident and emboldened that now is the time, that you have a president that wants something, that you're hearing, you know, from Toomey and maybe some other Republicans that they're interested in starting the conversation. And Democrats are strongly together on this. So they are feeling like this. If there was a time, now would be it. They just have to, you know, keep that momentum going, because that's what usually stalls these.
Well, Tam, there are guns, and then there is infrastructure. This week, Biden's cabinet and the president himself were out trying to sell this $2 trillion infrastructure plan. Of course, it includes roads, bridges, but also money for jobs and housing, and Republicans don't like that. What do you think? Did the administration make any progress this week trying to get that through?
Here's the thing. This is just 1 week, you know, like in the past administration, there were, I think, at least three infrastructure weeks spread out over 3 years. This administration is not going to stop talking about infrastructure until they break through to as many Americans as humanly possible. Whether they break through to congressional Republicans or not is a whole nother story. But they are working very hard and don't plan to let up on making the case that infrastructure is more expansive than what people might traditionally consider it to be. You know, whether they will succeed kind of depends on, you know, how well they make that case, and also how well Republicans are able to push back on it or somehow, you know, find elements in the proposal that seem absurdly not at all like infrastructure and try to convince the public like, oh, this is just a big pork filled Christmas tree of gifts and you know, Democratic priorities. And so that's the debate that is going to play out. And, you know, it seems pretty clear that the Biden administration has developed a formula with the COVID-19 relief bill, which was, we're going to smile and say that we want to be bipartisan. We will meet with members of the Republican Party, which they're going to do on infrastructure next week. And then at some point, they're just going to move ahead and try to do it through this reconciliation process and hope that the public doesn't really care about the logistics of the Senate and whether or not it had to have a quorum vote before it went to an up or down vote.
Well, Tam, as you're talking about this more expansive view of infrastructure that Democrats are taking, you're making me think of a trip I was on just yesterday. I was tailing Assistant House Speaker Catherine Clark as she was touring an elementary school in her Massachusetts district, and she was pitching the president's infrastructure plan. Here's a little bit of what she told me.
We are coming to see that child care is a public good, and it needs to be invested in just like we think about investments in roads and bridges.
So, Eugene, what about that argument? I mean, the idea is that, you know, you need roads and bridges to get people to work, and you also need child care so that people can be productive. Is that message sinking in Congress?
I think with Democrats, sure, absolutely. I think that they're kind of all on the same page as that. And, you know, what I've been hearing from people as I've talked to them as the infrastructure plan was being formulated and now proposal laid out is that infrastructure for Democrats is not just the old way of thinking, the roads and the bridges. It is what do we need in society to keep America going, right? Like, does that include roads and bridges? Yes, absolutely. But it also, to Democrats, it includes care, you know, $400 billion, I think it is, for the care economy and those kinds of things. And after, honestly, more than a year of a pandemic where the government has given people money and done things that they haven't done before, I think that the public is a little, we've had some polling that the public is even interested in this idea and realizing that, oh, child care, that is also, you know, call it infrastructure, call it what you want, it's something we want. And I think one thing that to remember is that the Biden administration, though they've talked about it as an infrastructure bill, they've also hammered home that it's a jobs bill. And so some of the things in here, some of the millions of dollars for training and things like that are also about jobs and the economy. So they're trying to, you know, have a two or three or four in one, whether that works with Republicans, it's hard to see it. But like Tam was saying, they see bipartisanship and kind of unity as, well, the public likes it, so we need to do it. And it kind of, if they don't like it in Congress, then too bad.
Tim, we have just about a minute left. I want to fit in just a question about the Biden administration today announcing a commission that would look at potential reforms for the Supreme Court, including its size. This feels like a big one, like a hot potato. How notable is this?
Well, and there are 36 members of this commission, so it's a big one in terms of the size of the commission, too. There's a long history of blue ribbon commissions doing reports that then sit in piles and gather dust. But this is a hot issue. This is something that progressives have been pushing hard to get the President Biden and just generally to try to change and shake up the Supreme Court. And this is, you know, a way of throwing them a bone, certainly.
Yeah. We'll keep an eye on that one. Tamara Keith, White House correspondent for NPR. Also Eugene Daniels, White House correspondent for Politico. Thanks to you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The Southeast is one of just a few places in the world where loggerhead sea turtles nest, but the state of Georgia is now concerned they face a threat from the federal government. It's fighting a change to the dredging of shipping channels. Molly Samuel of member station WABE has this story, which aired on All Things Considered.
Late one summer night, tour groups on a Georgia beach luck out. They come across a loggerhead sea turtle nest as it's hatching.
Oh my God.
Oh, whoa, oh.
This was a couple summers ago. The tiny turtles scramble up out of the nest and churn their flippers in a rush to the ocean.
How many are there so far?
I don't know.
One, two, three, four, five,
when a nest hatches, it's called a boil. There's so many turtles, it ends up being impossible to keep count as they bubble up from the sand.
This is so cool.
Georgia takes pride in protecting and tracking the turtles that come here to lay their eggs. But now, wildlife officials say the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers threatens the same turtles the state has worked to save. The Corps plans to change its schedule for dredging shipping channels. The dredging keeps them deep enough for ships to get to and from the ports here. But the equipment can hurt and kill wildlife. Biologist Mark Dodd with the Georgia Department of Natural Resources says the dredges are like giant underwater vacuum cleaners.
The pumps just suck material off the bottom, sand and mud.
And they can pick up sea turtles from the ocean floor, too. Dodd says after getting sucked in, the animals hit a blade like a propeller.
And they get chopped up and don't survive.
So the past few decades, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has kept its dredging here to the winter months to minimize killing sea turtles. But last summer, the Corps got permission from the Trump administration to dredge in the Southeast any time of year. And it wants to start dredging off the Georgia coast in May, which is when the adult females start coming here to lay their eggs.
Killing nesting females is especially devastating to conservation efforts.
Catherine Ridley is with the Georgia advocacy group 100 Miles.
We're sending these turtles through a wood chipper.
But the Corps says conservation is actually the reason for the May dredging.
Well, really, we're not trying to do some evil thing here.
Nicole Bonin with the agency says the change in schedule is to take into account other protected species across the region, from North Carolina down to Puerto Rico. For instance, Atlantic sturgeon and North Atlantic right whales, which are on the Georgia coast in the winter when the dredging has been happening.
None of us want to see turtles harmed. This goal is to try to figure out how to do everything better for all the species.
Advocates are skeptical. They say in 30 years of winter dredging, there's no proof that it's hurt right whales. But in 2009, an experiment with summer dredging was stopped after it killed six turtles in 2 weeks. Georgia officials are pushing back on this federal plan, but they may not have any power to stop it. For NPR News, I'm Molly Samuel in Atlanta.
And we're going to hear now from a 13-member pop rap group called Brockhampton. They've got a new album. Here now is Tanya Mosley, spoke with a few of the members.
6 years ago, a new kind of boy band hit the music scene, one that bucked the boy band formula.
The light is worth the wait, I promise, wait, why did you do it? The light is worth the wait, I promise, wait, screaming please don't do it.
Brockhampton is made up of 13 friends who serve as everything from vocalists to producers to photographers and app programmers. The members identify as gay, straight, Latinx, black, and white.
Sick of these giving me false info, like I ain't grow up on MTV, Boondocks, and the Chappelle Show.
This song, The Light Part 2, is from the group's new album, Roadrunner, New Light, New Machine, which is out today. And one critic has called Brockhampton one of the loudest voices of a generation, treading the line between pop and trap house rap, which is why some fans were shocked to learn that Roadrunner could be one of the band's last albums.
You got to know when to, like, end something, I think. And that doesn't mean, like, the family or the friendship would end or anything like that. It's kind of just, like, breaking away from making music as, like, a rap group, boy band, whatever.
That's Kevin Abstract, one of the lead members of Brockhampton. Roadrunner is the band's sixth release, and Kevin says this decision to make it their last album is less about breaking up and more about evolving. And that means shedding this label of boy band, even though the group used the term as a way to subvert pop culture's idea of what a boy band looks and sounds like.
I would just rather lean into making stuff that feels real and not having to, like, you know, try to live up to even what we said redefining a boy band means, you know? I'd rather just, like, get to the core of what we love, which is honestly, like, just rap music.
Who let the dope boys out? Thank God you let me crash on your couch. Who's my God that I'm praying to now? Early 2000s, they try to jump me in. Latino protection, any direction, you gave me your blessing. Texting, I text them, I told them I got them. Told them I made it to Hollywood. All it took was a summer to fail. A platinum record, not gonna keep my black out of jail. Super fails.
This track is called Buzzcut. It's from the newest album, Roadrunner. And like so many people, the band was changed by the isolation and grief experienced over the last year. One of its members, Joba, lost his father to suicide. And Ramil Himnani, one of the producers, says you can hear and feel the pain in their music.
When you hear something like this and you see, like, the pain you someone you love is going through, it kind of shapes your perspective in a different way. And that finds its way into, like, the songwriting and the process of making the songs and the videos and the art and everything.
That expression of emotion is a signature of the group's sound. And Kevin Abstract says, in many ways, being forced to slow down during this pandemic kind of served as inspiration.
Before lockdown, I would say I wasn't that inspired to make another album or anything, but I was just watching this Beastie Boys documentary, and me and Ramil saw it together, and that kind of, like, it just made me feel, like, ready to lean into being a creative again.
Kevin, what was it about the Beastie Boys documentary that really sparked the creativity inside of you?
I think it's just, like, you know, seeing the spirit of Brockhampton kind of live within the spirit of the Beastie Boys, and I think that just, like, it just got me excited, just seeing, you know, them make what they thought was the coolest stuff and just using each other to make that and seeing how they evolved, honestly, and, like, how it felt like there was a moment where they were kind of boy bandy and then they wanted to, like, you know, branch off and do something that was just totally left of that. That was a really big inspiring thing for me because I just always want to switch it up, really, you know. It's boring otherwise, so.
Yeah. A lot of us were living together, too, so. And something we started doing is we would just DJ for each other. A lot of us learned how to DJ, like on CDJs. And we got to the point where we would just make songs, and then the goal of those songs would just be to play them in a DJ set that we would play for, like, the four other people in the house.
I feel like that's when stuff kind of, like, start to take shape. Started making songs for fun again and not trying to, like, make anyone happy other than ourselves. And I think, like, just following that throughout the rest of the year became the blueprint, really.
I hear that you guys are also planning a live performance at music producer Rick Rubin's revered Shangri-La Studios in Malibu. Are you guys ready?
Very excited for that. Rick is like our Jedi master.
Oh, so I'm sure.
He's one of the first people we always play our albums for. This is a great soundboard. And the thing with Rick is, like, whether he likes something or dislikes something, what it forces you to do is, like, really look at your opinion on what you're making and be like, why do I like this? Or why don't I like this? Like, if Rick Rubin says he doesn't like something and I really love it, I have to sit there and be like, okay, Rick, this is, like, why I like it. And it just kind of forces you to, like, double down on what you believe in.
The last song, The Light Part 2, says the light is worth the wait.
When that hammer pulled back, did you think of me? You were the one that taught me how to be. Look at me now in all my glory. Overcame a lot, that's a different story. Abandoned by the life giver. Looking back at my life different. Deep cuts in the dusk of the final gasp before your life flashed. What happens when you die? Does it fade black?
With all that you've gone through over the last year, the collective grief that we've all felt throughout the world because of this pandemic, what is the light that you're looking forward to in the future? And I'll start with you, Ramil.
It's funny because the light to every single member of the group, it means something different to them, which I love. And it allowed us to create something that felt cohesive and like it came from one brain while still having the group's individuality and everyone's different personality in it. Like you wake up in the morning, you go stand in the sun, and it's just like it kind of washes you over. You're ready for the rest of the day. Like whatever happened yesterday, you don't think about in that moment.
What about for you, Kevin?
For better days as well, honestly. I agree with everything Ramil just said. That was really the main goal, really. Just like giving people something that will uplift them and make them feel better about whatever it is they're going through, kind of thing. That's kind of how it was, like making the music for us. The whole process felt like that, you know?
Kevin, a lot of fans are looking forward to this album, and a lot of folks will hear this conversation we're having and want to consume your art for the first time. What I'm hearing from you is that you're also evolving as an artist and you're evolving as friends in a collective in this group, Brockhampton. What do you want people to take away from the work that you've done and what they can expect from you possibly in the future?
I really just want to tell stories and become a better storyteller, really. You know, whether that be through aesthetics or sonics or whatever. And I hope that, you know, people just can see themselves in our work. Fast break to the depths in the sky. Impermanence turn permanent with
a nod. That's life. That's life. Kevin Abstract and Ramil Himnani of the group Brockhampton. Their latest album, Roadrunner, New Light, New Machine, is out today. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
A majority of Amazon workers have voted against forming a union in Bessemer, Alabama. The final tally, 1,798 votes against, 738 for. This is a closely watched count because the Bessemer facility could have become the first unionized Amazon warehouse in the U.S. Amazon opposed the effort and appears to have scored a victory, but the retail, wholesale, and department store union is now filing a legal challenge to the election, accusing Amazon of interfering in the process. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, for folks who are just tuning in to this vote, what was the struggle all about? What was at stake for both sides?
You know, Calum, I think for both, the most important thing is that this would have sort of broken the seal on the notion of Amazon warehouse workers being able to unionize and then require the company to collectively bargain wages and benefits and working conditions and things like that with the union. So symbolically, I think it's like, you know, you could consider it the first major battle in a war. And obviously, strategically, you want to win those battles and keep the momentum on your side. And so for now, it's on Amazon's side after this first vote.
This was a precedent-setting vote for Amazon. I'm wondering about the broader implications for labor relations in the U.S. for other big corporations as well. What do you see?
So as you pointed out in the introduction, one important thing is that Amazon really fought this campaign very aggressively, including a very aggressive social media campaign and requiring workers to go to what were called information sessions about the union. And those are being criticized by activists as being basically anti-union lectures from the company. So there are politicians and activists who are really kind of latching on to these types of tactics and calling them an example of how labor laws are kind of stacked against the worker. So I think that's an important thing to keep an eye on now, especially as progressive politicians are kind of on the upswing after the last election. I think a lot of companies will be watching Washington now to see if this kind of has any ripple effects in Washington and in labor laws specifically.
And meanwhile, the episode in Bessemer may not be over just yet, because the next step is most likely litigation over the election practices. As we mentioned, the union will be filing a legal challenge asking for a hearing from the National Labor Relations Board, which oversees the vote. Do you think there's any real chance of overturning this result?
All right. So the NLRB would have the power to call for a new vote if they did throw the results out. I wouldn't want to predict whether or not they'll do that, Calum, but one thing I would point out is that one of Biden's very first acts as president was to fire the general counsel for the NLRB, the guy that was appointed by President Trump. And he also named a Democrat to actually head the entire board. So I do think it's safe to say that the NLRB is probably more labor friendly as far as the leadership goes now than it was a year ago. So keep that in mind when you think of this appeal to the labor board and the possible resolution to it.
Yeah, it's an interesting backdrop as we have President Biden coming in as he pledged to be the most pro-union president you've ever seen. His labor secretary, Marty Walsh, is the first former union member in that role in many, many years. So there's a lot to unpack here. I know that you'll be keeping watch on it. That's Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Colin.
The second week of testimony in the murder trial of Derek Chauvin wraps up today, and we'll spend some time now reviewing key moments. On Monday, Minneapolis Police Chief Madeira Arredondo testified against his former officer, saying Chauvin's use of force violated the department's policies when he pinned George Floyd to the ground with his knee.
To continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
On Tuesday, Minneapolis Police Lieutenant Johnny Mercil testified that they do train officers to place a knee on someone's shoulder if the suspect is resisting arrest. But Mercil said what Chauvin was doing wasn't allowed.
And how long, based on your training and experience, does it typically take to render a person unconscious using a neck restraint?
My experience is under 10 seconds.
Under 10 seconds?
Yes, sir.
Now, when a neck restraint is applied, does the Minneapolis Police Department specifically train people to be cautious when reviving or attempting to revive a suspect?
I'm not sure I understand the question, sir.
In your experience, after a person has been rendered unconscious using a neck restraint, is it possible for them to continue to fight after they come back to consciousness?
It is possible, yes.
Have you experienced that personally?
I have not experienced somebody fighting after neck restraint.
Okay. But you're aware the Minneapolis Police Department trains people that is a possibility.
Yes, sir.
And in fact, sometimes they can be just as aggressive or even more aggressive after coming to consciousness.
That is possible, yes.
Chauvin's defense team also argued that the crowd that had gathered to witness the arrest distracted the officer. Here's Officer Nicole McKenzie speaking to Chauvin's lawyer.
Have you ever had to perform emergency services in not even a hostile crowd, just a loud, excited crowd?
Yes.
Is that, in your experience, more or less difficult?
It's incredibly difficult.
Why?
Because if you're trying to be heads down on a patient that you need to render aid to, It's very difficult to focus on that patient while there's other things around you. If you don't feel safe around you, if you don't have enough resources, it's very difficult to focus on the one thing in front of you.
Can be distracting.
Absolutely.
And so does it make it more difficult to assess a patient?
It does.
Does it make it more likely that you may miss signs that a patient is experiencing something?
Yes.
And so the distraction can actually harm the potential care of the patient.
Yes.
The defense also tried to show that drugs found in Floyd's blood contributed to his death, but experts testified they found no evidence of an overdose. Pulmonologist Martin Tobin said fentanyl did not affect Floyd's breathing. In fact, it was a lack of oxygen that killed him.
So that was roughly a 17-second clip?
Right.
Is that number, the respiratory rate of 22, significant to this case?
It's extremely significant.
Why is that?
Because one of the things in this case is the question of fentanyl. And if fentanyl is having an effect and is causing depression of the respiratory centers, the centers that control breathing, that's going to result in a decrease in the respiratory rate. And it's shown that with fentanyl, you expect a 40% reduction in the respiratory rate. So with fentanyl, his respiratory rate should be down at around 10. Instead of that, it's right in the middle of normal at 22.
Dr. Tobin said it was Chauvin who played a key role in Floyd's death. He described how much weight the officer pressed on Floyd's neck.
So, Dr. Tobin, what do we see here in Exhibit 943?
What we're seeing is that half of his body weight plus half his gear weight is coming down. That's 91.5 pounds is coming down directly on Mr. Floyd's neck.
Is that all we see?
And the reason we're seeing that is because the toe is off the ground and there is no body weight sitting back. He's not hunkering back on his heels. So everything is directed down on his knee. In this place, his shin and his toe and his boot is playing no contribution.
The prosecution brought another medical witness to the stand. Dr. Bill Smock is a surgeon. He works for the Louisville Metro Police Department. The prosecution asked him about CPR and when it should have been performed on George Floyd.
So in the interest of time this afternoon, I won't show the additional video, Dr. Smock, and I want to ask you about a different subject, and that relates to CPR. Could you tell us about the importance of timing with respect to performing CPR?
The sooner we start compressions and ventilations, the higher, the more successful our resuscitation rates will be.
At what point should CPR have been commenced with respect to Mr. Floyd?
Way before it was. As soon as Mr. Floyd is unconscious, he should have been rolled over. We have documentation on the video that the officer says, "I can't find a pulse." Why? That's clearly. But when you look at the video, it should have been started way before. Should have been rolled over, checked his respirations. But clearly, when they can't find a pulse, CPR should have been started.
Thank you, Dr. Smock. No further questions.
Testimony in the trial of Derek Chauvin continues today. Witness testimony is expected to run through the end of next week. All right, hold on to your particles, people. We're going to do some science here. The results of an international science experiment this week sent shockwaves through the world of physics, and it's all due to a tiny particle's surprising wobble. Scientists have spent decades trying to get a closer look at muons, subatomic particles so unstable that they blip in and out of existence in a matter of microseconds. On Wednesday, scientists at Fermilab in Illinois revealed evidence that these muons wobble or spin in a way that they shouldn't, according to the standard model of physics that has governed the field for decades.
This is really the equivalent of a Mars rover landing moment for us.
So why is that tiny wobble such a big deal? Well, scientists like Fermilab's Chris Pauly thought they'd accounted for every bit of matter or energy that could possibly move the muons, and the new measurements suggest that they are wrong. That extra motion could be the fingerprint of something outside the standard model, and that's a scary idea for scientists like Pauly.
There might be monsters we haven't yet imagined that are emerging from the vacuum, interacting with our muons, and this gives us a window into seeing them.
To get the new super precise measurements, scientists shot billions of muons at nearly the speed of light through a 50-foot magnetic ring that had been cooled down to minus 450 degrees Fahrenheit. Pauly says all of that effort paid off when the results came in.
Hundreds of people contributed to it. Thousands of people years went into this effort to build and analyze the data. And it all came down to this one unblinding moment where after all that effort, we were able to see what the final result was.
Ada El-Khadra of the University of Illinois also worked on the experiment. She says if their preliminary results are confirmed, it could upend the standard model of physics. And already, their finding has been called the biggest thing in their field in a decade.
People often think of it as the last missing piece of the standard model. I think of it as the doorway into the landscape that lies beyond the standard model.
And if this is a doorway to a world beyond the rules that have governed physics for decades, who knows what else is waiting to be discovered on the other side.
Since its debut, the Netflix series Bridgerton has charmed viewers with romance and intrigue set in an alternative Regency era.
If this is to work, you must appear madly in love.
It is an absurd plan.
I find it quite brilliant. Provided you do not wish to marry me, and I do not wish to marry you, whatever should you have to lose?
That's the show's leading man, played by Reggae Jean Page, who will not be back for season two. Page, who is black, reportedly turned down a salary hike to return to a show otherwise known for its diverse cast. For more, we're joined by NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, Page played Simon Bassett, the Duke of Hastings, the most eligible bachelor in England. Let's listen to a little bit more of him in this role.
People not for an overzealous mother at every corner. This time of year in the city, not be so very dreadful.
Those mothers simply want the same as you, I rather think.
For every last one of them to choke on their daughter's hair ribbons.
Do you declaim a wife, Hastings? Are you truly not planning on taking your place in society? Will you have a dukedom?
I have a title, as far as I'm concerned, will end with me.
The Hastings,
will
you can't...
stop calling me that? It's my father's name. Never mind.
Playing this reluctant aristocrat was a career breakout for Page, and yet he won't be back for another season, Eric. Why?
Cheerio. You know, I hear those British accents, and it just makes me want to talk the way they
you
do.
You can't resist, can you?
You can't resist. So according to reports that we've seen in the trade press, Bridgerton, the series, is sort of hewing to the storyline of Bridgerton, the novels that it was based on. This character was really only a factor in the first novel, which they told in the first season. And so the actor said that when he was approached to do the role, they had told him it would be for one season. The show's producers went back to the actor and asked him if he'd be willing to make a guest appearance, and they offered him a bit of a pay bump, and he turned it down. I'm sure he has a lot of attractive offers in front of him. He was a breakout star from that season. And what we're seeing on social media, I mean, there's fans who are heartbroken and saying they won't watch the show if he's not in it. So obviously he made an impression and he's making the most of it. But people in the TV industry are scratching their heads because you don't mess with a breakout hit. And to have a key character that so many people enjoyed depart the show is just, you know, it's going to be a challenge for them. It's going to be a huge challenge for them.
Well, I think part of fans' disappointment is they liked Reggae Jean Page on screen, of course, but they also, I think, liked the way he spoke out about the importance of diverse representation in costume dramas like Bridgerton. In fact, here he is doing just that in an interview with CBS.
We have a very long and sad tradition of excluding people from stories, excluding right. people from history, literally painting people out of historical pictures and documents. And so it's the very least we can do to start painting people back in. I think if we're going to have a great, big, fun Cinderella fantasy for for Christmas, that the more people who can play, that more people who are invited to participate in that and see themselves as glamorous and worthy of love and status, the better.
So that's what he said on CBS, Eric. But as you mentioned earlier, I mean, season two is scheduled to follow the books on which the series is based. It's going to focus on a different member of the White Bridgerton family, which sort of pushes Simon Bassett out of the picture. I mean, is the series just limited by its source material here, or does it signal, you know, a deeper problem if they actually can't hold on to their breakout star despite reportedly offering him $50,000 an episode to be a guest star?
Yeah, I know $50,000 an episode sounds like a lot of money, but in Hollywood terms, you know, it's not exactly like they backed up the money truck to hold on to this guy. And so now we see we're in a situation where the characters of color are going to come and go around this white family that is at the center of the show. And I think if they had managed to keep that character, Simon Bassett, in the mix, it would have lessened that effect a little more. But now their challenge is to try and figure out how to create another character that's just as compelling and make that person a person of color. You know, stuff like that is kind of like lightning in a bottle, and expecting to be able to replicate that is kind of a tall order, I think.
Well, this search for whoever might be next, Eric, makes me think about something that the late Chadwick Boseman used to talk about. He sometimes talked about how there seemed to be only room for a small number of black male leads in Hollywood at any given time. And Boseman, of course, now is being awarded several posthumous recognitions for his work on screen. And while Regé-Jean Page has a promising film career ahead, he did say just this week, Eric, that he was hurt to learn that race was reportedly a factor when he was passed over for the role of Superman's grandfather in the TV series Krypton. So what does all this tell you about the state of affairs for black male leads in Hollywood?
Well, I think what it tells me is that there is a push and pull between people who are safeguarding the traditional way of casting shows and people who want to take chances. But if you look at the Oscar race, or if you look at the Hollywood award season race this year, you see a much wider range of leading men than I think we have ever seen. But what it does is it just reveals how limited our vision has been in the past and how much more that has to expand. So the good news for Bridgerton is that they now have a chance to develop another magnetic leading character of color to come to that show and do what the Duke of Hastings did in the first season. And I hope that they rise to the challenge.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, I would send you off with a thank you typically, but I guess I should say cheers today.
Cheerio, Governor.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.